Hello, my darling, and welcome to today's story time. Today we have a very spooky atmosphere to go with Lovecraft's The Tree. Now close your eyes, lean back, and let me read you to sleep. And now, on with our story time. Fata, Wiam, and Winian. They will find a way. On a verdant slope of Mount Menelaus in Arcadia, there stands an olive grove about the ruins of Avia. Close by is a tomb, once beautiful with the sublimest sculptures, but now fallen into as great decay as the house. At one end of that tomb, its curious roots displacing the time-stained blocks of Pentelic marble, grows an unnaturally large olive tree of oddly repellent shape, so like to some grotesque man, or death-distorted body of a man, that the country folk fear to pass it at night when the moon shines faintly through the crooked boughs. Mount Menelaus is a chosen haunt of dreaded Pan, whose strange companions are many, and simple swains believe that the tree must have some hideous kinship to these weird Panishi. But an old beekeeper who lives in the neighboring cottage told me a different story. Many years ago, when the hillside villa was new and resplendent, there dwelt within it the two sculptors, Kalos and Musides. From Lydia to Neapolis, the beauty of their work was praised, and none dared say that one excelled the other in skill. The Hermes of Kalos stood in a marble shrine in Corinth, and the palace of Musides surmounted a pillar in Athens near the Parthenon. All men paid homage to Kalos and Musides, and they marveled that no shadow of artistic jealousy cooled the warmth of their brotherly friendship. But though Kalos and Musides dwelt in unbroken harmony, their natures were not alike. Whilst Musides reveled by night amidst the urban gaieties of Tegea, Kalos would remain at home, stealing away from the sight of his slaves into the cool recesses of the olive grove. There he would meditate upon the visions that filled his mind, and there devise the forms of beauty which later became immortal in breathing marble. Idle folk, indeed, said that Kalos conversed with the spirits of the grove, and that his statues were but images of the fauns and dryads he met there, for he patterned his work after no living model. So famous were Kalos and Musides that none wondered when the tyrant of Syracuse sent them deputies to speak of the costly statue of Taishi, which he had planned for his city. Of great size and cunning workmanship must the statue be, for it was to form a wonder of nations and a goal of travelers. Exalted beyond thought would be he whose work should gain acceptance. And for this honor, Kalos and Musides were invited to compete. Their brotherly love was well known, and the crafty tyrant surmised that each, instead of concealing his work from the other, would offer aid and advice. This charity producing two images of unheard of beauty, the lovelier of which would eclipse even the dreams of poets. With joy, the sculptors hailed the tyrant's offer, so that in the days that followed, their slaves heard the ceaseless blows of chisels. Not from each other did Kalos and Musides conceal their work, but the sight for them alone. Saving theirs, no eyes beheld the two divine figures released by skillful blows from the rough blocks that imprisoned them since the world began. At night, as of yore, Eusades sought the banquet halls of Tegea, whilst Kalos wandered alone in the olive grove. But as time passed, men observed a want of gaiety in the once sparkling Eusades. It was strange, they said amongst themselves, that depression should thus seize one so great a chance to win art's loftiest reward. Many months passed, yet in the sour face of Eusades came nothing of the sharp expectancy which the situation should arouse. Then one day, Eusades spoke of the illness to Kalos, after which none marveled again at his sadness, since the sculptor's attachment was known to be deep and sacred. Subsequently, many went to Kalos, and indeed noticed the pallor of his face. But there was much about him, a happy serenity, which made his glance more magical than the glance of Eusades, who was clearly distracted with anxiety, and who pushed aside all the slaves in his eagerness to feed and wait upon his friend with his own hands. Hidden behind heavy curtains stood the two unfinished figures of Taishi, little touched of late by the sick man and his faithful attendant. As Kalos grew inexplicably weaker and weaker, despite the ministrations of puzzled physicians and of his assiduous friend, he desired to be carried often to the grove which he so loved. There, he would ask to be left alone, as if wishing to speak with unseen things. Eusades ever granted his requests, though his eyes filled with visible tears at the thought that Kalos should care more for the fauns and the dryads than for him. At last, the end drew near, and Kalos discoursed of things beyond this life. Eusades, weeping, promised him a sepulture more lovely than the tomb of Mausolus, but Kalos bade him speak no more of marble glories. Only one wish now haunted the mind of the dying man: that twigs from certain olive trees in the grove be buried by his resting place, close to his head. And one night, sitting alone in the darkness of the olive grove, Kalos died. Beautiful beyond words was the marble sepulchre which stricken Eusades carved for his beloved friend. None but Kalos himself could have fashioned such bas reliefs, wherein were displayed all the splendors of Elysium. Nor did Eusades fail to bury close to Kalos's head the olive twigs from the grove. As the first violence of Eusades' grief gave place to resignation, he labored with diligence upon this figure of Taishi. All honor was now his, since the tyrant of Syracuse would have the work of none save him or Kalos. His task proved a vent for his emotion, and he toiled more steadily each day, shunning the gaieties he once had relished. Meanwhile, his evenings were spent beside the tomb of his friend, where a young olive tree had sprung up near the sleeper's head. So swift was the growth of this tree, and so strange was its form, that all who beheld it exclaimed in surprise, and Eusades seemed at once fascinated and repelled. 3 years after the death of Kalos, Eusades dispatched a messenger to the tyrant, and it was whispered in the Agora at Tegea that the mighty statue was finally finished. By this time, the tree by the tomb had attained amazing proportions, exceeding all other trees of its kind, and sending out a singularly heavy branch above the apartment in which Eusades labored. As many visitors came to view the prodigious tree as to admire the art of the sculpture, so that Eusades was seldom alone. But he did not mind his multitude of guests. Indeed, he seemed to dread being alone now that his absorbing work was done. The bleak mountain wind, sighing through the olive grove and the tomb tree, had an uncanny way of forming vaguely articulate sounds. The sky was dark on the evening that the tyrant's emissaries came to Tegea. It was definitely known that they had come to bear away the great image of Taishi and bring eternal honor to Mucedes. So, their reception by the Proxenoi was of great warmth. As the night wore on, a violent storm of wind broke over the crest of Menelaus, and the men from far Syracuse were glad that they rested snugly in the town. They talked of their illustrious tyrant, and of the splendor of his capital, and exulted in the glory of the statue which Mucedes had wrought for him. And then the men of Tegea spoke of the goodness of Mucedes, and of his heavy grief for his friend, and how not even the coming laurels of art could console him in the absence of Kalos, who might have worn those laurels instead. Of the tree, which grew by the tomb near the head of Kalos, they also spoke. The wind shrieked more horribly, and both the Syracusans and the Arcadians prayed to Ilios. In the sunshine of the morning, the Proxenoi led the tyrant's messengers up the slope to the abode of the sculptor, but the night wind had done strange things. Slaves' cries ascended from a scene of desolation, and no more amidst the olive grove rose the gleaming colonnades of that vast hall where Mucedes had dreamed and toiled. Lone and shaken mourned the humble courts and the lower walls, for upon the sumptuous greater peristyle had fallen squarely the heavy, overhanging bough of the strange new tree, reducing the stately poem in marble with odd completeness to a mound of unsightly ruins. Strangers and Tegeans stood aghast, looking from the wreckage to the great, sinister tree, whose aspect was so weirdly human, and whose roots reached so strangely into the sculptured sepulchre of Kalos. And their fear and dismay increased when they searched the fallen apartment, for the gentle Mucedes, and of the marvelously fashioned image of Taishi, no trace could be discovered. Amidst such stupendous ruin, only chaos dwelt, and the representatives of two cities left disappointed. Syracusians, that they had no statue to bear home. Tegeans, that they had no artist to crown. However, Syracusians obtained, after a while, a very splendid statue in Athens, and the Tegeans consoled themselves by erecting in the Agora a marble temple commemorating the gifts, virtues, and brotherly piety of Mucedes. But the olive grove still stands, as does the tree growing out of the tomb of Kalos. And the old beekeeper told me that sometimes the boughs whisper to one another in the night wind, saying over and over again, "I know. I know." And this, my darling, ends today's story time. As always, I hope that you have very sweet and creepy dreams.